I won't go into every clause, but you'll see from the legal framework the reference to the National Assembly Rule 157, which does provide that a document which is protected under provision law may be placed before a committee as a confidential document. I must emphasize. The other point is a reference to the 7, clause 7 here, a case in point, case law involving the Constitutional Court and so on as well. And analysis, 8 on the same page. In terms of the National Assembly Rule 1573, this document is not yet officially before the committee. The chairperson may place the document before the committee or may allow the document to be placed before the committee. It is recommended that, given a clear statement of confidentiality on each page, that the document be placed before the committee as confidential. And it asks the advocate does refer to a number of other clauses on page 4 here, and the excerpt, and so on. And under 9.2, attorney-client privilege is acknowledged by law in South Africa to allow clients to be open and honest with his attorney without fear of discussion being displaced on the discussion. This is aligned with the fact that not to incriminate yourself, which is entrenched in section 351C of the Constitution. The document 9.3 appears to originate in a foreign country, although South Africa is a sovereign nation. Good international relations must weigh significantly towards treating the document as confidential. Now, what is suggested to us in conclusion here is that it is recommended, etc., that given the consideration set out above, the committee takes the decision to treat the document as confidential. 12, it is further recommended that the committee requests De Beauvoir and Plimpton LLP to disclose who its client was. The committee may then request a copy of the report from the client as the holder of the privilege. 13, until such time as the committee has received the permission to use the report and can thus determine the value of statements contained in the report, it is not recommended that the Department of Trade and Industry be required to answer to the report. Now, that is the advice before us. And there is one other clause here, which perhaps you can just refer me to, Mr. Herman, in which it indicates that the committee itself, if the document is placed before you, you know, here, then we can determine, I think it is, 0.5, we read that one out. I think it's under analysis 9. When the committee considers whether to treat the document as confidential, it is recommended as the following. So, in placing the document before the committee, we would then take a committee position. In her doing so, documents her that we would treat it as confidential. That's up to you. So I think that is a fair comment here. Other groups or parties or individuals who may wish to make their own inquiries from the advocate and so on, obviously, always free to do so. So that is the position. Yes, Honourable Vandenova.
Chair, I only have the experience that I've gained having been in this Parliament some time. But it is my understanding that this committee serves as a proxy essentially for the Speaker. In other words, anything at the table here should actually come through a process of Parliament. So any new document that comes from anywhere goes through a system that involves the Speaker's office. It would then be my question, where does the documents originate, and has it been presented to Parliament, which is essentially what this committee represents, has it been presented to Parliament through those channels? I'm anxious about it because we have an open committee here, we have three people present. The confidentiality is that what it is, the confidential document, I might be compromised by coming directly to this committee. And I think there's a lot of implications for that. So I'm really requesting information about where the document comes from, who presented it, and whether it's gone through any official parliamentary process to get to us.
Right. Are there any other hands? Yes, Mr. Honourable
Hill-Lewis. Chair, all of the questions raised frankly need to be taken up as an honourable mania, because the key point, the information contained in that document, is already now in the public domain. It was in about six newspapers the day after our last committee meeting. So, you know, whether the document itself is confidential is actually beside the point now, because the question on which we want the DPI to answer has already been published far and wide.
Thank you. Right Honourable Khazebe.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. I think that as this committee, we must accept this legal opinion which is coming from advocates, panel members. But what is also critical, Chairperson, we must avoid using this committee as a lobby point for taking outside parties. So that's why I appeal for a situation whereby in the future, that if no document was presented to this committee properly, we cannot accept anything which is coming from any other. The member of parliament can attend any meeting, but cannot come and present things which are not presented in this particular committee. I feel that the land must, we must have to move into the future.
Thank you very much for that. Just a moment here, please. Before that, if that's all right. asking for for us to postpone this matter until before the committee. Yes. I don't want to delay this. Right, Honourable Kelly.
On a question of clarity, can we just get very concisely what the recommendations are again? Now, as I understand it, number one, that the committee consider the document as confidential, but that we can see it in committee. And number two, that we do not use the document, we do not make the DTI answerable to the document. Are those the two recommendations, so I have them correctly?
Well, those are two of them.
Are there others as well?
Well, they are, I've just asked the committee secretary to distribute the four pages.
Right.
And you can peruse them at your leisure.
Thank you.
No, I mean, not leisure, but I mean during the course of the meeting. All right. I didn't want to go through clause by clause, blow by blow. Okay. I'm sure now you've got no one to agree with you. All right. So while that is going on, I am just looking at the apologies here, and I'm not aware of an apology from the Honourable Kamala that you made. And then looking at the rest here, we seem to have everyone else there. So we seem to have curves, you know, AMCDA curves here. On the IFC, we're also listing on Bolivania. Okay, is that right? Okay. So at this particular stage, we do not have an apology from Honorable Kamala, Honorable Bolivania, who is the full-time person here, and was an effect of a minority grouping. That is, we have written to the House chair's sort of, under whom this mandate falls, and he is busy consulting with the minority parties, and he will, I'm sure that matter will be resolved very soon, because right now the Honourable Elders is effectively in terms of the ACC, but yet in terms of the rules. It has to be agreed to by the fellow colleagues in minority parties. But as we've engaged, Honourable Flaherty.
For the record, I just want to know whether the classroom affair is still a member of the committee.
We're trying to ascertain exactly who the member is from the minority grouping. We do not have that clarification. So I need to make that very, very clear. And it's not a decision of, say, a particular member of the administration or the political leadership is here in that, but it is a matter, according to the rule, for the minority parties to resolve. So I don't think it's going to help us to go down that route now. Thank you. So we will now move on. Sorry we've taken that long, and my apologies to you then, DDP Karim. I do apologize. And of course, you are very, very welcome. And I must say, just seeing you here reminds me of the Russian evening. So, this is very pleasant, the whole evening. Thank you. But it's over to you and your team, and I'm sure that you will introduce them yourself. Thank you. Before we do that, the committee secretary is reminding me we should have adopted the agenda. It is our intention to finish as soon as possible to enable members, if they so wish, to go to the lock-up. Right. Thank you. Do we have someone to propose the adoption? Thank you, Honourable Mandanova. Seconded, Honourable Mabasa.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to all the honourable members. I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to give this report.
report on the 8th WTO material in Geneva that was held on the 15th and 17th of December. I think the committee may be aware that we had certainly, the department had circulated a more comprehensive report sometime in January, early January, I believe it was, which provides a lot more detail than this presentation does. Comprehensive report of all the main interventions, the intervention by Minister Rob Davies at the WTO ministerial meeting, and a series of communiques that we had negotiated in the run-up to Geneva that sets out, I think, the overview of the state of play in the WTO and with respect to the Doha negotiations in particular. The presentation itself is quite brief and broad. It sets out some of the key elements of the process, of the preparatory process for the 8th ministerial conference, and it highlights some of the key substantive outcomes and positions of South Africa in that process. So I'll be happy to try to answer any questions that may arise after we go through the presentation. With respect to the preparatory process, the department is in ongoing discussions in NEDLAC, NEDLICO, which is a subcommittee of trade, in NEDLAC that discusses all the trade negotiations and trade issues that come up. There's an ongoing engagement in NEDLAC where WTO and preparations for the WTO ministerial conference have taken place. Members that participated in the National Consultative Conference in Joburg on the 28th November will recall that was an opportunity where we engaged broadly with a range of constituencies, parliament, business, labor, and communities were represented at that national consultation. And to a large extent, I think the outcome of that, of those consultations, was a largely consensus view, a great deal of consensus among the constituencies on how South Africa should approach the WTO ministerial conference. The South African delegation to, for shorthand, we call the MC8, the ministerial conference, the 8th ministerial conference. South African delegation to MC8 included MCs from this committee in particular, but also representatives of business, labor, community, constituencies as part of the delegation at giving the conference. We had ongoing engagements, I believe, just about every day in the morning or in the afternoon, where there were ongoing discussions about what was happening during the different engagements that different members of the delegation had been engaged in. And that has been a standard feature of South Africa's participation in WTO conferences. I must say that this is probably, we're quite unique in this respect for taking delegations that are broadly representative of in South Africa, including MPs. And this is quite unique in terms of WTO members in general. Before the engagement started, the meeting, the conference itself, we had met with members of the Southern African Customs Union, representatives in Geneva. These are our member states that belong to the Customs Union, members of Botswana, Swaziland, Namibia, and Lesotho, along with South Africa, again to try to ensure that we are on the same page with respect to our position for MC8. Part of the preparations involved a meeting of the BRICS trade ministers, ministers representing Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. This is a historic meeting, the first time BRICS has met in the context of the WTO. and also coincided, and we'll come to that a little bit later, with Russia's accession. And the chair made reference to the evening where the Russian celebration of their accession had taken place. The BRICS came up with a ministerial declaration outlining their common position for MT8. This was followed by meeting G20. Again, just to underline that this G20 is not the G20 that we generally refer to in the context of the financial crisis, that emerging financial crisis. This is the G20 of agricultural, the agricultural grouping of developing countries in the WTO that has led the developing country positions on agriculture negotiations in the Doha round. There was a new alliance that had been established in the run-up to MT8 called Friends of Development. And this alliance, this grouping consists of over 100 countries, developing countries. They include countries from the African Union, least developed countries, the ACP, and the BRICS as well. And to say that with respect to these preparatory meetings with BRICS, with SACU, with Friends of Development and the G20, again, there was a large degree of consensus in terms of how to approach the conflict issues themselves. In addition to this, over the course of the 3-4 days that we were in Geneva, Minister Davies held 15 bilateral meetings, and these are specified in the overall report that we have prepared. Again, consulting on approaches to the WTO, to the MT8, but also in some cases dealing with specific bilateral issues with particular countries. As we were aware, and I think we had the discussion at the National Conference, the MT8 was not a negotiating session for the Doha round. In the run-up earlier in 2011, there was a widespread recognition that the Doha negotiations are effectively at an impasse. There's been no movement on any of the main issues of negotiations for at least 2 years. The MT8, it was a regular meeting of the ministerial conference. We were required to meet every 2 years. And this time around, the decisions that came out of MT8 were focused largely on the non-negotiating WTO matters, regular matters of the work of the WTO, but not non-negotiating. Nevertheless, there was clearly going to be some engagement around how the reasons for the impasse in the Doha round, and the possibilities that this could be restarted in the near future, and on what basis. And in the run-up to MT8, there were a number of proposals that had been put on the table, mainly from developed countries, about how we could move the negotiations forward. But the two key proposals came from a group of developed countries that were proposing to advance negotiations on what they call a plurilateral process, that if, in fact, you couldn't have a negotiation on the entire agenda of the WTO, there was not agreement to move on all of those, and with all members, that perhaps what we needed to do is to move with on a few issues with more limited numbers, and that's essentially what the plurilateral approaches include. It's not a comprehensive multilateral negotiation, it's more limited set of negotiations with a limited number of members on a limited number of issues. The same countries identified, the same group of countries identified what they thought would be important new issues for negotiations. They talked about the relationship of, beginning to discuss trade and energy, questions of food security, competition, and investment. These were proposals in the run-up to the 8th Ministerial Conference, and we had to some extent, prepare our in preparing for the negotiations, we have to take those into account. Preparing for MT8, we have to take those into account. essentially, the core reason for the impasse in the Doha negotiations, it has been a repeated attempt over many years, particularly from developed countries, to erode what we understand to be the Doha developmental mandate, which underpins these negotiations. And effectively, what countries, industrial countries, are arguing is that new emerging economies, such as China, Brazil, India, to some extent, South Africa is also added into that, but also countries like Indonesia and other ASEAN countries. They're making the argument that these new economies are growing. They are taking an increasing share of international global trade, and that they need to make greater commitments, undertake greater commitments in the Doha round for the negotiations to move. What we put out there is that very often when we've raised the question, they're asking for greater commitments from developing countries. What are they prepared to contribute to secure that in the context of these negotiations? They very often say they've already put too much on the table themselves. So this is a one-way demand of developing countries to make further commitments without the typical concessions. And to a large extent, this is at the core of the impasse in the negotiations. I'll come back to this in a little bit more detail towards the end. Minister Davies delivered South Africa's country statement reaffirming the developmental principles and mandate that were agreed to in 2001. That is included in the comprehensive report that we had submitted to the committee. And this statement sets out South Africa's position on Doha very clearly. I would certainly recommend that for an understanding on Doha, that the minister's statement be looked at. It does set out the key positions of South Africa in some detail. There were three working sessions that were arranged over the course of the 3 days in the MT8. The working sessions on the future of the multilateral trading system, questions of trade and development, and then specifically on the Doha development agenda. And in those meetings, we effectively elaborated what the minister had said in the overall statement, elaborating and providing more details in those working sessions. Our overall assessment, and this is not only our assessment, I think the general assessment, is that in the course of listening to the country's statements, in the course of the engagement in the three working sessions, it's very clear that there is a profound divide between developed and developing countries on the Doha round. And it's unclear at this stage as to when the round would be able to restart and when it would be, and on what basis it would be restarted. In considering that, the WTO Director General Pascal Lamy had made one concrete proposal that he would want to convene a panel, a multi-stakeholder panel, in the course of this year that would begin to debate and discuss how the future of the WTO and the future of the Doha Round. And with respect to that particular process, we are engaging in preparations and we'll consider how we make a contribution towards that. As I said, the decision, the MT8 was not a negotiating session as such, but a number of decisions of the regular workings of the Ministerial Conference were addressed. This included six or seven key points that we have on this slide. The decisions that involve the accession of new members to the WTO. Russia was obviously the most important, the largest economy, major economy that has been outside the WTO, now is a member. Montenegro, Vanuatu, and Samoa and the effectively now WTO membership covers 95% of world trade. There was a standard decision to extend existing decisions on with respect to waivers for customs duties on e-commerce and on intellectual property non-violation.
Credentials of the
points repeatedly, that we're committed to the principles of multilateralism, transparency, and inclusiveness. And in that respect, the proposal for plurilateral negotiations would undermine these principles and in effect would further marginalize development from the negotiation process. We argue that these approaches of the multilateral plurilateral approaches are apex. The aim of this is to extract greater access into the market for emerging economies, and we argue that that is unacceptable. The point that we try to make over and again is that while emerging economies like China, Brazil, India, and others may be rising, may be growing fast, they may be taking a larger share of world trade, the fact of the matter is that the level of development as compared to developed countries is so far apart, and these countries, emerging economies, still confront profound developmental challenges that need to be acknowledged. In response to the proposal to introduce new issues, our argument was that introducing those issues are premature given the fact that we have a great deal of unfinished business in the Doha round, and that must be the priority process. Secondly, in summary, our argument was that the new approaches that we've seen in these proposals are unfair, unmandated, and anti-development. What we did advise, and again this is reflected in the BRICS statement, the Friends of Development statement, is that if we can move on one item over the course of this year, it would be to provide a package of measures in favor of least developed countries. These are the poorest and most vulnerable economies in the international trading system, and they deserve, because of the overall impact, we should at least try to deliver something for them. And this would lend legitimacy and credibility to our that's the overview of the report that we have provided Chairperson, and happy to try to answer any questions or clarify any of the points that you've raised through that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much to D.D. Kelly. I must say, for those of us, the person was able to extend an invitation to the Honourable Harris, the Honourable Kulasa, the Honourable Khadebevi, myself, of course. It was, I believe, Honourable Harris agreed, very informative and very, very welcoming experience for us to at first hand obtain an experience of how these things work, and etc., but also to be able to contribute in the different fora and workshops, etc., that work around. And as I say, I don't want to preempt some of the comments of my colleagues or their questions or clarifications, but thank you once again.
Thank you.
another teacher.
Thanks very much. And thank you to Mr. Karim. Two comments. Firstly, it would seem from the report that the minister's efforts at bilateral talks are very much more fruit than the kind of formal Doha negotiations, multilateral negotiations are at the moment. And is there an effort from yourself and other departments to really ramp up the number and intensity of those kind of talks? Because it seems that while the Doha is at impasse, we can make up a lot of ground on other things by using it as a bilateral avenue. The next question is not strictly related to your report, so I hope you won't mind me asking, but it's we have recently entered BRICS, and we have also recently started something of a discussion with one of our BRICS partners, Brazil, in the last couple of weeks over allegations of chicken dumping. And if I remember correctly, there was a special tariff that now applies to Brazilian imported chicken. Now, what has been the effort, if any, to resolve that? It seems like the Brazilian government is going to complain about us to the WTO, and who knows what happens there. But have there been efforts outside of that process to resolve that amicably?
Thank you very much.
I just want to raise that there are a lot of acronyms. Some acronyms I am not able to call anybody down to the obstacles. My ability to follow the entire thing. There are acronyms, and I have made specific reference to those that I think I don't understand. Like we have your LDC and your ACP. You have your DDJ. You have your LDC, not LDC, LDC, and you have your LDC. These are the acronyms I don't understand.
All the acronyms in general, yeah.
Thank you.
He said that 95% of trade now will be covered by the WTO. What implications does it have for these negotiations as we're moving forward? We know Russia, but we know that it was difficult for it to fit to that. So with this partition and this partition break, what effect is going to have? Is it going to shield it? Is it going to be able to shield the field in our favor or not? And then the last one will be the issue. I read the Sunday newspaper completely. And one certain Ukatron really characterized the global situation as it is. He said that after 1945, Japan was moved. We do that unfortunately. And then Germany was devastated. Yeah. Number three, Britain remained bankrupt. From the Second World War, immense bankrupt. And then America emerged as the most powerful force. 50% of the GDP of the world was coming from America. Whatever is in the world, it has declined about 23%. So it is the power of the United. Really, I could think also in that WTO plenary that it was in the best food. All the countries were rising against it. What can it mean to be? What can it cause to be in the whole world? If it can be good for us. Because I can see that they want us to vote for the Aguado, where we're going to become there.
Clearly, the service in the economy, which has been dominant
in Europe, and probably part largely the cause of the current decline now. It has had a negative effect, obviously. What are the new approaches now that would influence the negotiations that the WTO, in particular, in other words, is there a new approach in place reindustrialization and increased trade? An approach that they want to follow, and what implications would that have on the door around and particularly on the globalization? I raise this question because the Europe is our largest country.
Thank you very much. As yourself saying, Mr. Karim.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And thanks to the honourable members for all their questions. Let me start by apologizing for the acronym. We usually put a list at the back of this where we explain all the acronyms. It must have slipped this time around, but certainly we will provide the information. Maybe just quickly, just to facilitate this discussion, LDC is referred to least developed countries, poorest countries. ACP is the African Caribbean Pacific grouping of countries. The DDA is the Doha Development Agenda. SDE is small and vulnerable economies. It's a different grouping to least developed. MTS is the multilateral trading system, but we will provide a full breakdown. I think there are a number of other acronyms in the report that we also need to explain.
I just wanted to say, in a lighthearted way, that an acronym is a set of abbreviations that spell a word. So RDP is not an acronym, it's a set of abbreviations. But DEAR, which is growth, employment, and growth, is an acronym. Sometimes it may spell a nonsensical word, like DAWG, D-A-W-G, or something. But an acronym actually is a set of abbreviations that spell a word which either makes sense or doesn't make sense.
So what are initial phrase words like a LCD?
That's a set of abbreviations.
Well, there we are in the more professional academic background. They are coming to the fore, as it were. All very helpful, all very helpful.
I'm going to avoid all of those. The Africa's Growth and Opportunity Act. First question. Well, all the ones I mentioned are acronyms. They are all acronyms. The AGOA didn't come up in the discussions. AGOA is as we know, is a unilateral offer of market access by the U.S. for sub-Saharan African countries that meet a range of criteria. It is effectively a bilateral issue between sub-Saharan Africa and the U.S. It didn't come up in that context. The question, I think the Honourable Member that raised the question about AGOA was making reference to the question of South Africa being graduated out of AGOA. also the benefits of AGOA, and this is a discussion that we have, an ongoing discussion about the engagement, the discussion that we have in our ongoing engagement with the U.S. So it's something that we will have to come back to from time to time, but it certainly didn't come up in the WTO. The second questions, second set of questions refers to whether or not there's a greater focus on the bilateral agenda, and I think the best advantage is to say that for the last 4 or 5 years, even longer, we've pursued all avenues. We've pursued the WTO negotiations. There are a range of advantages of negotiating deals at the multilateral level. You tend to get a much more inclusive, more balanced outcome than when you enter into bilateral negotiations. But indeed, we have also been negotiating bilateral deals. Over the last 4 or 5 years, we negotiated a deal with the EFTA countries, those European countries that are outside of Europe. We negotiated a deal with Mercosur. We're currently negotiating a deal with India. We've been working in the region, in SACU and SADC, trying to advance the integration agenda there. But I think what it does mean is that in the context of the impasse in the WTO, clearly we're going to see more progress, in these other engagements. The focus of the department, and I think we have to continue to monitor over the next year, 2 years of developments in the WTO. We don't expect the negotiations to move for a number of reasons that I'll come back to a little bit later. But we think that we will be able to see progress in negotiations with India. We will be able to build relations with BRICS, not necessarily trade negotiations or tariff negotiations, but simply build trade and investment links. And we're certainly going to put a lot of effort into getting our house in order in SACU and in SADC, and also the Minister has spoken a number of times about the work on the tripartite FTA, which will essentially create a free trade area between 26 countries in Africa, stretching from Cape to Cairo. Those would be our focus, and I think that we're more likely to see our progress over the next period. But that's not to say that we will give up on the WTO and on the Doha Round. We have to continue to keep the developmental agenda alive in that context. The question arose about the recent anti-dumping case. I think essentially this is the process of initiating and implementing anti-dumping duties is a statutory process set up in the ITAC Act, the Act establishing the International Trade and Investigation Commission. If an industry constituting a particular company constituting a particular size, particular percentage of the industry, of the local industry, believes that there are imports that are coming into South Africa at below normal price, they can approach ITAC to initiate an investigation. ITAC would, in that case, if they believe that there is a case worth pursuing, they can institute preliminary duties on those imports. And I think it would have been sometime in October, November, ITAC would have introduced preliminary duties. Because there's a belief that the imports are being sold below cost or below normal price, and it's damaging the local industry. They then have a certain period. This is stipulated in WTO rules. It's also incorporated into the ITAC Act. That would outline a procedure through which they have to investigate, technically investigate, consult with the industry, go to Brazil to assess what the company's cost structures, etc., and try to make an assessment. And over that period, once they've completed this investigation, there's a finding that either there is dumping or there isn't dumping. And I think in this case, ITAC has, in fact, I wasn't here last week, so I'm not sure if it was the final decision, but I was under the impression that, that ITAC had found that there had been dumping and were going to implement a definitive duty on that. This happens amongst all countries. Brazil is an active user of dumping, anti-dumping, they call trade remedies. South Africa uses it, China is, India uses it, the US. It's an instrument to address what is considered to be unfair trade between countries, but at the hands of particular companies. So I don't see this as something that would undermine the BRICS relationship. It's a normal part of our trade relations. And in fact, in the context of liberalizing global economy and economies opening up, you're more likely to see an increase in resort to trade remedies of different kinds, where there's a consideration either that there are subsidies or there's some unfair trade. I want to also thank the honourable members for the supportive words to the department, and particularly our participation at MPA and also the team in Geneva that has passed those messages on to them. I think over a period of time we have managed to upscale and improve the quality of our representation in Geneva, and that certainly was on view at MP8 in the manner in which we were able to engage. With respect to the question about business committed to South Africa's position, I know that there will be a presentation by Musa later on, but I must say that in terms of our processes in NEDLAC, where we've engaged with business, and at the preparatory consultative conference in Johannesburg in November, our leading was that there is a great deal of consensus among constituencies with respect to our negotiation in Doha Round. So on those issues, on the type of issues that lie in the Doha Round, as a country we appear very united. I've seen this, I think, a lot more in our international engagement, where South Africa tends to come together, South Africans tend to come together when we engage in international engagement, particularly in the area of trade. Not always, but certainly in this case, it appears quite evident. The question of Russia's role, I think Russia is, there is a procedure, they were formally, there was a formal extension.
There's something wrong with that mic, so just switch it off for one moment.
See on that?
Yeah, right.
Russia is formally in, I see the two WTO, but there is a procedure of ratification of the agreement in terms of the Russian domestic processes. So it would have to go to their Duma, to their parliament, it has to be, there are some laws that need to be changed. And so the formal adoption of all the rules and requirements set out in the WTO, as they informed us, would take place by mid-year this year. So to a large extent, what we're still seeing is them working their way into the system in terms of the administrative and legal requirements of the WTO over the course of at least the first half of this year. Probably in the second half of this year, we'll begin to hear Russia, how they intend to participate in the WTO. And I don't think we know enough to say how they will align. What we can say, though, is that the accession process itself is extremely onerous. I think it took requires extensive changes to their legal regime. All their laws that relate to international trade, trade remedies, licensing laws, tariffs, were up for negotiations in this. They had to make extremely tough concessions, mainly to the big players, in order to buy their membership into the WTO. It will have benefits to Russia insofar as Russia will have now access, the same access as everyone to international markets. They won't be able to treat them differently to other WTO members. They will be governed by the same set of rules, but they would also have to open up their markets to WTO members, and in some cases take on commitments, in some cases even beyond what any of us have to are obliged to follow. That's one of the real problems in the accession process, which is that everyone takes a pound of flesh when you're trying to join that organization. I think the question about whether or not we're being polite by saying it in or is it something, is it in a worse state than that? This is precisely the debate. The developed countries, in particular, a number of developed countries have been making the argument that the Doha Round and the Doha Mandate is no longer valid, given changes since the launch of the Round in 2001, and that you need a new mandate. And effectively, what they're saying, what the subtext of that is that developing countries, particularly emerging developing countries, have to take on equivalent concessions and commitments as developed countries. So they're essentially trying to erode any differentiation between emerging economies and developed, now industrial, as we understand to be industrial economies. And that is the core of the discussion. We're seeing the same type of dynamic playing itself out in the climate change negotiations, where again a number of developed countries are saying they're not prepared to take commitments or continue their commitments under the Kyoto Protocol unless they're equivalent commitments from major developing countries. Our response in the trade context, our response is yes, it's true that developing countries are growing. And it's true that they are now sources of global trade and investment, and will be over the next 20, 30 years. And they're important, they're important contribution to international trade on the one hand. On the other hand, if you look at on a range of criteria, Human Development Index, GDP per capita, the amount of high value added products that they actually trade, there's still a large difference between so-called OECD or industrial countries, their development status as compared to China or India. There are huge developmental challenges that we all face. It would be the same argument we would make for South Africa. They would want to argue that South Africa should take the equivalent commitment because we are at the same level of development as say the US or the EU. I mean, it's patently not correct. They are growing, they are made important economies, they will take up a larger share of trade, but the differentiation between developing countries in reality remains, and that has to be reflected in the mandate. And this was the mandate that we agreed on. We used that as the basis for the negotiation from 2001 in Doha, and it's strange that sort of 10, 12 years on, when you're reaching the conclusion of it, there's an attempt to change essentially the rules of the game and change the mandate when you're about to conclude. So our view is that we need to retain the mandate. It's still valid, it's still relevant. Doha is still an important undertaking that we all committed to, but I think all of us are going to have some further reflection on know that this is an ongoing debate in Geneva now. I think I'll add to this. The number of RDAs in this, the number of think tanks, the Director General has talked of the establishment of the stakeholder panel that will try to have a discussion. I think everyone is a little, it's unclear on how we're going to move this forward, but there are clearly different positions of Anderson premises. Without outline, I think it's the South African position at this time. The plurinationalism is effectively a agreement within, not necessarily only within the WTO, it could be inside the WTO, it could be outside, but it is on a limited number of issues with a limited number of countries. So anything less than the full WTO membership, anything less than the full package of issues that constitute the Doha agenda, if you combine those two, a fewer group of countries is negotiating fewer issues that would constitute a plurilateral negotiation. And essentially what it is, I think another way of saying it, I think in a different, in the political context, the US quite often it refers to coalitions of the willing. So you put together a group of countries that are prepared to negotiate something and you move on that. And if there are others that are not comfortable with it, they're left, effectively left out. What they try to, they generally argue is that you would negotiate with the main players in that particular area. So if you want to talk about negotiating, international technology, trade on international technological goods, the ITA, for instance, you get the countries that constitute 80% of trade in that area, and they would have an agreement. When you look at who are those countries, in general, they tend to be developed countries. And so, developing countries, poorer countries are excluded almost automatically from many of these negotiations because we're not the biggest traders in the world. China is important, India is important, Brazil is important, the big economies, developing countries, we didn't want to bring them in. But most of African countries, many Latin American countries, Asian countries, wouldn't constitute what they would call a critical mass for these negotiations. So there's a marginalization, there's a fragmentation of the multilateral system, and that's very opposite of the principles of multilateralism, of inclusiveness, and principles which the Doha Round is, and the WTO is supposed to be built on. The Friends of Development grouping, it's a new name. I mean, we've had similar types of groupings before. They adopted this name this time around precisely in response to what we have all understood is a threat to the developmental agenda. So the ACP, AU, LDCs, a number of them, now we talk of the BRICS because they're in, but Brazil, India, Ipsos previously would be, and sometimes China would join us in that, would try to develop a common position at a very broad level. It's the level of principles and quite a number of common positions on specific issues. So if you look at the declaration that the Friends of Development have put together, you'll see it's around the principles of multilateralism, the principles of inclusiveness, against plurilateralism that will fragment the system, not agreeing to new issues that will be old issues. Exactly the point I've argued to that South Africa. So at that level, we have common ground. When you get into some of the details, then you'll see that we don't understand each and every case. But certainly for the MTA, this is important. That at the level of principles and approach is a great deal of common understanding amongst over two-thirds of the membership. I think the final question that I forgot was on the question of the Eurozone and the impact on Doha. I think what we've seen is that the European Union has always been an advocate for Islam, and they had always been at the forefront on trying to conclude Doha Round. And in a sense, what our understanding is that they have undertaken a reform in agriculture as part of the common agricultural policy reform process. They started this in 2003. They've had a number of further movements. I think the last one, I believe, was in about 2003, 2004, further reforms. And our understanding is what they wanted to do is they wanted to take this and lock this in the WTO and make this part of the international commitments in the WTO in order to get commitments from others in areas where they have an interest. Now, that process has moved. So in a sense, if they don't conclude this round, if there's no conclusion to this round, their reform, they're not able to extract any concessions for the reform that they're undertaking. They will just do it. They'll not get anything additional for doing it. So that has, I think, been at the core of their strategy to try to conclude this round. And so it was the EU had argued in 2008, we were close to concluding a round. They were close to being, they were prepared to work a bit more, but they were concluding. There were other states that had more difficulties with the commitments on this. I think what with the Eurozone crisis, it would seem to me is that they would, they're probably not going to be able to go back on their commitments or their internal undertakings to reduce their support to the farmers. In fact, I think their budget situation is such now that even what they're already doing, they may have to cut back further. So I think it doesn't have a direct bearing as such in terms of what they've offered already in the round. But I haven't looked at that in detail. But I think in terms of their participation in Doha, it's likely that they may not change their perspective. The plurilateral, again, to come back to the question on the plurilateralism, this has been advanced as a way to move the negotiation forward, but in principle we oppose it because it's fragmented system and it undermines and it's likely to further marginalize our most vulnerable countries because they don't take a large share of international trade. The question of rethinking approaches in the Doha Round, I think these are the points that were raised about industrialization or reindustrialization. Those are the types of things that we are going to have to put on the table now. As you look to the WTO, to the future of the WTO, define its role maybe a bit more carefully of what contribution effectively does it make to development. What is the role of industrialization in this? This is possibly part of the discussions that are going forward, but I don't think we're at the stage yet where we're very clear on how we want to move things in this as this debate opens up. We still need to do a lot more analysis. Chair, I hope I have answered some of the questions.
Certainly, from the point of our pleasure, the Europeans have covered it all. Thank you very much for hearing. And members, quite clearly we have all been, I'm sure by now, received the actual text copy of this, and it will give us time to study it in depth, especially having had certain clarifications and comments from yourself. Now, thank you very much indeed. Really appreciate that. And of course, we will be. members, let us, I would refer to a matter of the confidential document before we embarked on this aspect of the agenda, this item. Now, what I've been doing is I'm continuing to seek a minimum clarification. Unfortunately, perhaps because of budget day, the certain team members are not table staff, people, speakers of themselves, are not actually readily accessible to us. But they will be, of course, tomorrow. So what I would like to request is that, first of all, I shall hand out, of course, the legal advice that we have received itself, and so that on Monday, I mean on Friday, we can return with a definitive position. So I've asked the committee secretary during the tea break to make all pages from advocate Van der Merwe, whom we are familiar with, to make these available and accessible not only to full members, but of course also to the alternate and Mr. Honourable Mania himself, who was present, and Honourable Indy Kalana during that. And once again, thank you very much, Mr. Kareem. Members, just over to the minutes very briefly. Unfortunately, Mr. Herman's did attend to certain critical issues yesterday that took him out of Parliament, and I do have certain challenges with some of the points in the committee in the minute, and I've asked him to review the case yet again so that we can, we don't waste your time in committee making what are corrections that perhaps the chair could have also edited earlier. So please take through these minutes anyway. They are the minutes for the, we're not going to adopt them now. They are the draft. I've asked for them, if you do not already have them distributed, to be distributed. And if necessary, if there are any changes, we will bring the amended draft to you so that it can come down to adoption. But they are extensive minutes, that's why I'm handing them out now as well. So on that note, members, I would like to ask you to take a running tea break. So may I suggest, given the size of this room, get staffing, but you can immediately remove that chair that doesn't provide an obstacle for those of us who can't jump over it. And then if we can, get our tea, get whatever sandwiches you wish, and come straight back into committee. Thank you very much. Shall we call it a 5 minute break? Thanks. I'd like to welcome members of the Minister, Mr. Justice Mandidora, and Ms. Lee Kaliachi. You are both very welcome, and I'm sure you realize we would like to proceed without further ado. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to honourable members of the committee for this opportunity. I think Madam Chair has already introduced who we are, so I will sort of plow straight into the matter at hand. Just to sort of give a clean picture before we get into the meat of the matter, what we've tried to do here is to present business views and perspectives on the ministerial. We won't go into the same depth on the detailed policy issues that the tariff that Karen went into, but we'll try and lift out a couple of key points, and I think most importantly lift out a couple of suggested action points on what we learned from the ministerial and what we believe would be beneficial to take forward. And just to give an idea of the contents of our presentation, we'll summarize our position on the ministerial, give a couple of observations. session, propose a couple of ways forward, and then conclude the main meeting. One of the key points which was already highlighted by government was the current, I won't call it an impasse now, I'll call it the current crisis of the Doha round, because it really is well and truly deadlocked, and it will probably take a long time endeavor for this impasse or this crisis to be resolved. I think we all within business accepted this point, and we all accepted that things are currently extremely difficult, but the ministerial is still an important opportunity to see how things are done and to get an idea of the various new points and dynamics going on. And I think on this point, I'll echo a point that was raised by Madam Chair, where she thanked the DCI team and the mission in Geneva for all the hard work they put in. This was a point we also raised with the Minister and with Ambassador to say we really appreciate this being a part of this process, and it was a real eye-opener. And we also appreciate the continued discussions and the continued engagement we have with the government, with the DCI. Firstly, bilaterally, and also within NATO. To go on to the next bullet point, the reason for the deadlock has been well articulated and are well understood. And by and large, in fact, almost entirely, business is fully in support of the South African stance on the main issues of the Doha round. As a background, immediately after the preparatory conference before the WTO ministerial, we drafted a very brief position paper and we forwarded that to the portfolio committee and also forwarded that to the government. But that goes into more detail about the policy areas that we'd like to emphasize and an agreement on. But I think suffice to say, government and business and labor were in very much broad agreement on the main negotiating process that South Africa undertook. A key point to emphasize is that despite the crisis in the Doha round, the multilateral system will still be very important in the world trading system. And the primary reason for that is it's more transparent than anything else out there. And also it's a rules-based system whereby, in spite of its many flaws, it is not a simple strength issue when there's a trade issue in play. So, in theory, a small developing country can take on a big, powerful developed country under the system and be sure that this case will be heard. But again, I emphasize there are flaws in the system in the sense that resources will come into play in such a case. To continue on business's main position, we feel again that the WTO has played a very important role in creating, in overseeing, and I guess in enforcing the rule-based system that the multilateral trading system is currently engaged in. But as we all know, some serious imbalances have come about, particularly for South Africa. The issue has been raised before, whereby South Africa was classified as a developed country, and during the Uruguay round, we undertook some very deep cuts to our protection for our industry. And I think the effects of that have been quite profound. So this has echoed itself in a number of other developing countries, and we share government's view that the Doha development round should be and should continue to be about correcting these imbalances. This, I must emphasize again, is a sentiment that's been shared very, very strongly by business. The Doha round should remain about business.
Yeah. Just
a
short for a moment, just a second. It seems to want to put you on the phone
and
now
put
you back
on. Okay. All right. So, in terms of what the Doha round should be about, we share the sentiment very strongly that this should be what the Doha development round is about, and that any attempt to erode the developmental mandate will not be acceptable in the developing country. When we say all that, therefore, we need to emphasize that the deadlock itself is of huge concern to business, because ultimately, it's a lost opportunity for the multilateral trading system to be more even, particularly in respect of developing countries. So it's a huge source of concern for us. In our view, an ideal situation would be a Doha development round that is successfully concluded so that we have this multilateral trading system we spoke about, but one which is not disadvantageous to developing countries. now what I believe, or what we believe is the meat of our presentation, which is our observations and our ideas from the ministerium. As Mr. Karim mentioned, there was, I think there was a common view amongst labor, government, and business on what this ministerium should be about and on what South Africa should articulate. And in our view, this was very strongly, very eloquently, and very clearly communicated to the ministerium. It was also an opportunity for us as business, for those of us who have a view on the South African delegation and the ministerium. It was an important opportunity to see the various dynamics that were at play. It was instructive to hear our minister putting forward our views in a very clear and forceful way, and to also hear, on the other hand, those whose views we do not share articulate their thoughts. It's completely different when we see it, and when we see it happen, and when we see all the dynamics around it. I think we found that extremely important. But I think also importantly, the fact that South Africa was very broadly representative in terms of its constituencies, we found that very, very valuable. I think I could even have put an explanation on it. The reason is that, as a general rule within the way we engage, I will give the example of MedTech. We are engaged in detailed policy discussions on a day-to-day basis. We are basically chasing deadlines. We are working on a lot of things simultaneously. We don't have the opportunity to sit back and talk in terms of our philosophical view on things. And also just to share ideas on what we think are important issues. We found this very valuable. And I'll give a couple of examples on specific issues where we were able to engage in a way that we normally wouldn't have time to in our day-to-day
We need to have a beer together.
Geneva was the first opportunity that we had. But to give two very specific examples, there was an issue which was raised in our preparatory conference where we were talking about a package for LDCs. So taking these developing countries and trying to craft a package that benefits them, and promoting that stance in the WTO. The one issue we had, I wouldn't say discomfort, but the one issue we wanted clarity on was, would there not be unintended consequences? And what are we going to do to address those? To give an example, we are part of the Southern African Customs Union, and we have one least developed country, Lesotho, in our midst. So the question was, if, hypothetically, all LDCs were granted duty-free, quota-free access into third markets, would that not destroy the Lesotho's market for clothing in the USA, as just as an example? Because the likes of Bangladesh, Cambodia, Vietnam are least developed countries as well, and they would be able to produce the same goods at a much lower cost. So this was one issue which, in an informal discussion, we managed to discuss with the DTI, with Ambassador Ismail, and the answer we got gave us great comfort. We were able to go back and report to our constituents to say, this issue has been taken into account. We are unlikely to see an outcome that would be destructive for our labor members. Another example was the issue of our relationship with our other labor partners. As a lot of us will know, the discussions were quite robust in the WTO. People were quite forceful as I mentioned in reinforcing their views. And we were worried that would that not destroy our relationship with other partners. And we got a very firm answer from Ambassador Ismail, who is engaged.
Yes, just switch it off again.
Who is engaged in this process on a daily basis. And his emphatic answer was, our relationships with all our trading partners are mature enough to take the heat that is prevalent within the WTO and the Doha Round. And again, this gave us great comfort, and we were able to report back to our constituents to say that, look, this issue is under control, so to speak. So these are the sort of things, again, we normally don't have the time to consider. And I believe being part of a wider delegation, almost the Team South Africa delegation, gave us the opportunity to address such issues on a pinpoint basis. One thing that my personal observation was that business, labor, and government are talking, discussing, engaging on a daily basis or on a regular basis within MedTech. So as a result, each constituency has a broad understanding of each of the other constituents' viewpoint. And also, the relationship between the parties has matured and has grown to the extent that we can understand each other's viewpoints a bit more. And the portfolio committee will be aware that a lot of the documents that go to the NEDLAC come out based on consensus. So despite our very different and divergent viewpoints in the beginning, the NEDLAC process allows a space for compromise and for growing the relationship to allow it. And our feeling was that we would love to have a similar relationship with Parliament, because it will be very easy to have a situation where business views and parliamentary views are not communicated on a regular basis, and then it's easy to get this distance. And the Parliament is extremely important and critical to the functioning of, in my case, trade issues. I mentioned my case because I deal only with trade issues within my organization. So our view as a collective, business delegation, we need to engage more frequently with the portfolio committee in order to allow us to exchange views on a more regular basis. And this is something we feel very strongly about. Another way forward, this was an issue that was first raised by Minister Davis at the preparatory conference. And to paint a picture on what he raised, he mentioned that the likes of the USA have constituencies that are very vocal and are very, very well known worldwide. So to give an example, before South Africa goes into any negotiation, say with the USA, they already know what Congress thinks. Before we go into any negotiations with, say, Japan, we already know what the farming law in Japan thinks. And the request to South African constituencies was, make your voices heard. Make the world understand that South Africa is not one large entity, one amorphous entity where everybody thinks the same. The world out there should understand that we, as government officials, have to go back and reaccount to various constituencies for what they're negotiating. And his request was, make your voices heard, make that point clear, and that this strengthens the hand of the negotiators in the world, not only in the WTO, but in other trade negotiating forums. And I'll give an anecdote where we saw that in play, and where I think that was quite an eye-opener. There was a symposium by an organization called the ICTSD, which is basically an NGO for civil society in Geneva. And so the panel discussion on a WTO-related issue. And on the panel, you had a former U.S. trade negotiator, a former EU trade negotiator, and two representatives from developing countries, and a wide audience which included governments and civil society. Now, after the presentation from the main speakers, the former EU and the former U.S. negotiator basically repeated the views that were made by the U.S. trade representatives and by the EU trade negotiators, which was something we found quite interesting because they were not involved in that space anymore. So we took the opportunity to say quite loudly that not only has the world changed and that developing countries are more vocal in the multilateral sphere, but even within developing countries, things have also changed. You now have institutions where trade negotiators do not simply go and sign on a piece of paper and it's accepted back home. That if trade negotiators sign on a piece of paper, they will have to come back and account for it. And it would seem like the most obvious thing, but we saw, genuine surprise. We saw genuine surprise from a large part of the audience, especially the two former trade negotiators. And one of the remarks made by them was, they'll be quite interested to understand why is it that you had business with particular views in 1995 during the Uruguay round, and why now business is suddenly vocal, and why it seems as if almost there's now accountability to government officials. So I think that point of making our voices heard, it came out there, and I think going forward is something that Team South Africa could continue to articulate, that South Africa is diverse and accountable, and therefore, when you're looking to negotiate trade agreements with us, please bear that in mind. To move on to my third point, in pursuit of getting a better understanding and engagement with Parliament, we would like, I think we've already tabled the request, a high-level strategic discussion where we basically exchange ideas on upcoming trade priorities. In our view, it would be desirable to have business, to have labor, to have parliament, to have civil society, and have an open discussion, almost on a philosophical level, about things such as the tripartite FTA, Saku-India negotiations, the future of the Doha Round, and all these important trade and industry issues. I mentioned industry at a later point because it's not my portfolio, but again, it's extremely important as it's within the ambit of the portfolio committee. So this is something we think would be extremely valuable, and it's something we will keep trying to achieve. As a conclusion, the request for the high-level discussion or dialogue I mentioned, I believe, has been forwarded to the portfolio committee, and might then will be considered soon. To emphasize again, the engagement between business and government and labor, especially within NEDLAC, is extremely strong and is ongoing. And we feel that by working with parliament, then the circle is complete. All the major role players in trade policy will be talking on a regular basis, and I believe that can only help, and that can only facilitate decision-making and sharing of views on trade policy issues. With that, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members, for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mandigora. I think we do concur that the all found is highly favourable. Perhaps at this point it will be over to our members of the committee to comment, raise any questions, and so on. Yourself first, then the Honourable James. I'm just looking to see if there are any other hands before us here.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I was curious as to what your view is on the proposal to have greater private sector participation, essentially through equity in the infrastructure development plan as outlined by the President. It's of a very important initiative to have infrastructure-led growth. And it cannot be achieved. I mean, the nation cannot get to the goals you want to get to unless there is participation on an equity level from the private sector. So I just wanted to know whether you clearly have reflected on this, I imagine, and if you haven't, if you can just share some of your thoughts on that.
Right, Honourable Kazembe, Honourable Mahasa. And Honourable Fula.
All right, thank you, Chairperson. I think I'll also concur with you, Chair, that it was really a good exercise that we had all these discussions around the table of the problem, and then we came to understand each other. And then I also appreciate the opening up of the use of the business part of it, because of 21. But what is also critical here is that there are certain policy positions which we have taken as Parliament of the Party. When we take policy positions, we consult very widely. And I can make an example. When coming to the issue of the industrial policy, I think there's one thing that's funny when we had the public hearing, that the business and labor, who are usually at short with each other, they were in total agreement on that flag. So a person will expect that when you go to the international forum, the issue of manufacturing sector within the South African economy would be the major voice which will be to ask for policy. And then we take the issue of the state policy itself. We also have an extensive party consultation of the party. The labor plus the business were part of that. There was a thorough engagement in such a way that it was adopted by Parliament, even the city expressed itself, adopted it as a good way forward. So what I'll expect is that when we go to the international forum, those things which are agreed upon must be articulated. I think the Minister was correct. It's good that the business must articulate it in its own way, as Parliament will articulate it in its own way, as the government is articulated it, so that we all have the same political understanding of what the country needs. So that's why the issue of further engagement with both is critical. But the question which I'd like to ask is that looking at the delegation of BUSA itself, if you engage all the stakeholders within the business center itself. So as I said, speaking for business, is Mamkani somewhere in the township, it was said in the Buddha side, you know, that's part of the success notion. And then also I think that we accept this issue of the engagement depending upon the problem of the business. But it was very fruitful to have worked with you guys on the other side.
Thank you, Honorable David. Honorable Master, followed by Honorable Sundar, followed by Honorable McIntosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question is based on the very first page on the presentation, the last bullet, business in exercising the importance of multilaterality. So my question there is, why this is being advanced as an argument or as a positive? How about mixing it with bilateral where appropriate? In other words, shouldn't we say that in certain instances we may find that bilateral are also relevant, whether pre or post or during, you know, that's one point. The other is, I believe that as committee members of this portfolio committee, we appreciate the position that USA put forward when it says we continually communicate, we continually engage, because out of that we can only be richer as a country and further the country. And my last point, which is not necessarily coming out of your presentation, but taking advantage of your presence here. In your broader various meetings, where by definition you might not touch, but could you tell me here, does BUSA do much with respect to cooperatives? Thank you, Mr. Committee.
Yes, no, thank you very much, Honorable Mabata, Honorable Salah.
Thank you very much. This is a human issue. What do we interpret? Trade or trade and industry? And which are you particularly representing, Bursa or representing part of them? I'm taking this from the angle that you say you can only consider this because we have trade and you divide it between industry as a large cost, you cannot be strict to it. Now, while I'm not sure of it, it makes me question the credentials that you, whether that's you, the presenter, or that's what you have said for trade only. And no business in this context would therefore mean trade and have nothing to do with industry, especially mining, agriculture, and all these kinds of things.
All right, thank you, Honorable Fuller. I have noted on the area that I'm cutting short, but Honorable McIntosh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's some relevance, but it is only a comment. On how open our economy is and how powerful some of our international companies are. If you look at the back of your appetizer, you will see that your appetizer is not made in Ceres or Elgin or the Free State, where Mr. Hadebe has many apple orchards, but it's made in Spain. Of course, maybe for South African breweries own appetizer and likes to keep the price of non-alcoholic drinks as high as possible in case we traditional beer. So it's just an interesting comment.
I must say, I thought the way to do this in theory was that they have shifted the location, but I think we ought to get clarification of that before I stop drinking it.
If I can make an urgent invention, we can consider it a matter of philanthropy to give some jobs to Spain at the moment.
Yes, well, over in that line, broader line, yes, of brotherhood and so on. But, yes, on the bright side, yes.
Only this one
is maybe it's the green one.
Oh, no, all right, members, we'll all investigate that later. Honourable Sabine.
The wife
is not bad. The wife is not bad. I just left one point. The issue of the application of the Business of Africa in supporting the multilateral system. Because, you know, I got a shock when the CDC said that the plurilateral system is the coalition of the willing. We know that what the coalition of the willing has done to the business in general. In general, you can go to Iraq. The coalition of the willing went there when the barrel of oil was $25. By the time they went up, it was $141. And then the coalition of the willing also went to Libya. We know what happened after that. Now I'm afraid, the business sector, do you do any research of the impact of such activity? Yes. Because we are about to speak about another one, just like the sanctions against Iraq. I know that South African business is involved in Iraq. If you do some research, because we have to remember what impact is going to have, so that as we engage the government, we also have known what the business is thinking about the looming sanctions against Iraq.
Right, thank you very much. And I'll just say, you know, Mr. Harima, yeah, I would really like to know about this apple tart issue. And I don't expect you to know right now, but I would like to respond. It has a long ring that this is now. What bottles in Spain or whatever? I mean, I really find this amazing. But of course, perhaps all in the interest of helping people. Over to yourself, Spain, Alusa.
Thank you, Madam King. The first question, if I understood correctly, was about our views on private sector participation in the infrastructure and price. Fairly recently, our deputy CEO, Professor Parsons, made a statement in which he felt that it's important to get the private sector involved in the infrastructure drive. There were a number of reasons he gave, I think he can put them out more articulately than I can, but I believe the main thrust of it is that it needs to be a partnership. Certainly, in terms of funding, it might be too much of a stretch to have government try and raise all the money on its own. And it would be useful to use private sector balance sheets, private sector expertise, private sector resources, and some, if you can call it that. So yes, we have clearly articulated through our deputy CEO that we feel strongly that we need to have a partnership between the private sector and government in this infrastructure track, particularly when we look at the scale of it and how important it is for the economy. On the issue of industrial policy, particularly in terms of reviving or strengthening our manufacturing sector. This is something that I'll say our members, but it's something that business feels very strongly about. To sort of move back one step, I think our biggest failing as business is not communicating the work we are doing. And I think it's something we need to remedy. To give just a couple of examples of some of the things we are working on. IFAC, the International Trade Administration Commission, administers and, I guess, looks after South Africa to counteract unfair trading practices, amongst other things. One of the things we saw, and the messages that came from our members, was that manufacturing has suffered because of an influx of imports that are much lower priced, that are very lowly priced, and there's suspicions of dumping and all these other things. Nothing in the legal sense of the word. Now, what we did is we opened up a very good dialogue with IFAC, whereby the main aim of that dialogue is not to push for a specific sector, but
to make sure that the systems are working well so that when there's unfair trade, it's addressed quickly and effectively. And this is an important thing because ICAC is the main defender against unfair trade practices. So we've opened up that dialogue directly with the Chief Commissioner, and I believe that from this point is working extremely well. To give another example, probably South African, business is very actively involved on the board, and business has given its full support to the organization because the main aim of the organization is to encourage the buying of local, encourage the buy local campaign. We are very active in that, and we've given our full and thorough support. And I think, almost as an aside, if one was to ask the proudly South African staff where the most pressure to deliver is coming from, they will say it's business, which might come as a bit of a surprise. But the main thing is that business is at the forefront of suffering together with labor from the lack or the weakness or the problems in the manufacturing sector. And this is one way to come up to address it. To give just another example very quickly, regarding our trade negotiations, we are, within NEDLAC as business, extremely forceful where we feel that where countries request market access that can harm our industrial capacity. We've been very vocal in saying so, and we feel that by sending a very strong message, it again strengthens the hand of government when they go and negotiate, even if it's to say no to a trading partner that seeks to enter the market with more favorable terms. So I think I just gave three very quick examples. In terms of industrial policy, we are engaged in the processes. IPAP, the new growth path, National Development Plan, we're very much involved in that. But also, I hope I get an idea of some of the practical on-the-ground things we're working on. Then there was a question regarding whether we engage all of business in coming up with our position. The way we are structured is, to give a very broad overview, in terms of policy making, we've got, I think, a membership of over 60 associations, and we've got the membership of all the major chambers of commerce. Now, the way we work is because we're the, you call it an apex body with membership, and with membership working through us. These associations represent a massive part of the South African economy, and the chambers of commerce are particularly important because small businesses are the primary membership of chambers of commerce. So they were very much involved in all our consultations. They were very much involved in the drawing up of all our policy papers. And we can only work through them in order to formulate and come up with policy and feel that it is representative. So in our view, in coming up with this position and all our other positions, we have consulted very widely. And to give one small sort of anecdotal example, in our consultations within NEDLAC, we were dealing with an issue regarding market access. And some of the sectors that we mentioned were not members of PUSA or were not working with PUSA. But in order to be sure that we're being representative, we went out of our way to locate who these sectors were, get their opinion, and feed that through the government. I think it would be too much to expect a team within government working on policy to try and phone up manufacturers and so on. So we did that on the full understanding that we wanted to represent as possible. I hope that answers. In terms of cooperatives and whether we do anything, what we've done is we've made a very conscious effort to involve particularly SMEs, because what we look at is to try and look at business, and we know that SMEs are generally the growth engine for an economy and for generating employment. So we've now got a dedicated resource that is working on SME issues to get their viewpoint across to make sure that they involve policy making. And then to feedback on important things that are happening throughout the policy landscape, not only on trade issues. So it's a very conscious and deliberate step we've taken recently. And also to emphasize, when our new chief executive officer came in, she named two priorities. That was small business development and unity within business. I'm sure you all know what the context of that. But without overstepping my mandate, those are the key objectives that she has. And within Busa, those are two, that's one initiative we've taken and deliberate step on. There was also the question of the multilateral system, and that given the current situation in the Doha around should we not mix with bilateral so that we're not relying entirely on the multilateral system? What one will find when consulting with business is we feel very strongly that if the consultation and the engagement is proper, we are very happy to have that mix. Because to use a colloquial term, we don't want to put all our eggs in one basket. We understand that you have the multilateral system which we fully support, but it's important to enhance our trade relations in the best way possible. And if bilaterals are the best way to do it, absolutely. So we're fully in support of the mix in terms of how we engage in our trade strategy. Our main point, and one which I must compliment government on, is that we must be regularly and thoroughly consulted, and I think to a very large extent that's already happening. And then the question regarding business unity South Africa, who exactly do we speak of when we say business unity South Africa, and also the question about why I put in the speech in one section when I was talking on trade issues. I think I gave a broad description of Busa membership, which shows what, who we represent and why. But the way we are structured within the organization in terms of internal way of working, we've got specific policy desks manned by a director with an understanding of that particular policy area. So in my case, my understanding is on trade issues, because that's my training and background. And we have a director for economic policy, and our deputy CEO is a pronounced economist. So my fear is that if I make a pronouncement and I get the policy area wrong, I wouldn't be doing justice. It would be my colleague who, the director of trade policy, economic policy, who would give a much better pronouncement on that. So it's not to underestimate its value, it's just to say I don't have the expertise on some of those issues. That's the reason for putting the issue on a different chapter. The comment that our economy is very open, we agree. And what we've seen, particularly within NetNet, is there's almost a backlash, if you can call it that, from business and from labor. So in some of our current trade negotiations and recent... So in some of the trade negotiations we've engaged in the recent past and currently, what we've found is that government business and labor are far less willing to grant concessions to countries that want more market access into South Africa. And the main reason is that we know that South Africa is a far more open economy than comparable developing countries. And this has been, it's a profound effect, and we need to make sure that we don't make that situation worse. So it's an acknowledgement, it is true, we have a very open economy with regard to, in comparison with other developing countries, and we can already see the consequences of that in the backlash that I mentioned. And then the issue of multilateralism, plurilateralism, and some of the effects that it has on the world. What we are fully in support of is the multilateral system, which is the one that is fully inclusive, which means if you're looking at the WTO, you're talking about the entire membership of the WTO. And we support that again because it's a rules-based and forceful system, which, although not perfect, gives a better platform for the weaker players than the bilateral system. On the plurilateral side, we made a statement in the preparatory conference before the WTO where we said, the proposal to make plurilateral, which is the coalition of the willing, compulsory, or to make participation in the compulsory, we are strongly against, we strongly oppose. So, in principle, we also share the sentiment that we do not want something that undermines the multilateral system. We want multilateral, not plurilateral. So, I think it's an important point to put across. I hope I've addressed all the questions, but if there's anything else, I'm happy to take any more questions from the honourable members.
It would certainly seem as if you have, whether they've been, members are satisfied with the other issue, but certainly you have responded to all of them. That's just one tiny little exigency, yes, honourable Mabasa.
Very tiny indeed. In your various meetings, it will help me to give me a very straightforward answer. Do you, in the agenda, sometimes have a topic or a subtopic that says cooperative? Right? I understand you do have SMMEs. Do you
I'm personally not aware of corporatism as a separate topic, but what I can do is I'll just double check with my other colleagues and then I can revert with a firm answer on that question.
Good idea. Well, thank you. If you would just respond in writing then on that particular one. There's just one quick point here. I know this time you say you retain what could only be described from what you say as very cohesive grouping and convergence on a particular viewpoint before you went across on these missions or engagements and so on. So, you know, I must say that although not quite within the plenary within the direct WTO section, I myself was a little bit surprised to hear an individual speak, a businessman purporting to represent business in South Africa with somewhat of a very different viewpoint than has been expressed here, or than what I have heard expressed about NIDA and the like. So it was puzzling, and although it had not been my intention to stand up and comment, I noticed that even the member of the opposition, Honorable Ferris, was somewhat surprised, as it were. So I do think that that matter could be followed up. Thank you. There's no need to make a comment unless you've done something already. Have you done something already?
No, Madam, it's a request for clarity on the...
Yeah, I'll provide that.
Okay, thank you.
Members, what we'll do, as you know, some of us, perhaps many people, would like to go down to the lock-up, as it were, quite an important day in terms of budget processes. So let us thank Mr. Mangigora for being here with us this morning and briefing us, and certainly this request, you know, more regular engagement and so on, will be taken up by NATO, looked at committee and so on, and we'll see how we proceed there, because the reality is our program is so tight at the moment with issues that we didn't deal with last year that we do need to deal with this year, plus, you know, three pieces of legislation. However, this should not preclude us from at least looking at yourselves and possibly thinking of Sundays or something. So let's just see how these things pan out, rather than being specific on the matter, because I know those days are your family days. Thank you very much. So, members, with respect to the agenda, the program, you've already been given the agenda, the Friday. I would like to look at the program again. We didn't make copies, but just to alert you, if I may just finish, okay, to alert you, and you will be getting this perhaps tomorrow, is that we have got a number of pieces of legislation coming to us, and it is a matter of urgency now that we close the gambling evaluation and bring it to the committee from the subcommittee. And so I have, of course, consulted with the chairperson of the subcommittee on gambling and indicated all the constraints we are facing in the program, and that the need, going back to 2009, for a call by this committee, which has gone to Parliament as well, that this broader legislation, the principal legislation, needs major amendment. Now, we can't get to that point, hand it over to the minister, before the committee. So because of that exigency, we would like to factor in, which I really do, because I know how busy we all are. We do want you to meet an extra day as a committee after hours. When I say after hours, of course it is still within Parliament's hours. But when I say after hours, I mean when you may have got other issues on board. That's why I'm telling you now. Now, I don't know if we've identified the day for the committee system. The day for the committee. We are looking at the 8th of March. The 8th of March, which is the Thursday. And when I say late, of course, I am looking, for some of you it may not be late, between 2100 hours. But of course, I realize some of you are night owls. But some of us aren't. So there we are, just that little warning. We'll look at it again on Friday, and you would have had an opportunity to study your own program. I don't want to give the details of the subcommittee meeting, because I know that you're going to engage, or you're not. Okay. Now, you had your hand up, Honourable Neil Lewis.
That's starting at 9 in the morning until 9 at night. School better program.
Oh, no, no, no. We didn't think you had that kind of attention. No. I mean, we break them between, you know. Yeah, you know, time for your caucuses, which they will allow you a much needed break. And then, after the half. Thank you. No
marathon.
So,
Madam Chair,
yes.
On just sort of that information, are you saying we would finish at 2100?
Yes.
Okay, not start at 2100.
Well, we could.
No,
sure. So, I mean, just wondering if that was a
problem. No, I thought maybe it's an all night vigil.
Well, it could be. That's what I'm saying. Are you proposing anything?
No.
It can be.
Definitely not.
Anyway,
thank
you very much. Thank you. The meeting has adjourned.
Chair, at our last meeting, I made the specific proposal that we require, that we request, rather, the DPI to provide us with the attendance registers of those meetings of the National Gambling Policy Council, which were not quorate. Apparently, we heard at the last meeting, for the last five meetings, it hasn't been quorate.
No, that is obviously underway with the Secretariat staff. So it is, you know, but I didn't want to delay this. We'll refer again to it on Friday with a report from yourself, Mr. Herman, on the matter. But just to indicate now, which has taken me a little bit of track here, on Friday, the 24th, please note 9 o'clock, finish at 1. The lack of lottery board is a very serious issue, of which I believe we are all seized with. So please cancel those flights you've already booked. Thanks. Meeting is adjourned for Friday, 9 o'clock.
Thank you.
The one from overseas,
which one?
The one from the good one. From Paris, what is it?
Well, unless we're going to force the